Hello and welcome to the Partners for Progressive Israel podcast. My name is Nicole Cooper, and I'll be the one guiding the discussion today. This recording took place in Jerusalem last month to start a conversation on two-state solution possibilities and what it might look like. I talked with Dr. Laura Wharton, who is a Jerusalem City Councilor and representative of Meretz. She was first elected to the City Council in 2008 and has some pretty interesting thoughts on the future of Israel and Palestine. Enjoy.
My name is Laura Wharton, and I'm a member of the City Council for Meretz, and I also head of the opposition in the council. I came to Israel from the U.S., where I was born and grew up and went to school initially. Those are the relevant factors, I think.
And you've been here for over 20 years, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm interested in asking about the possibilities of a Palestinian state and an Israeli state alongside, and what you think that could look like, and if that is a possibility.
I think it's not only a possibility, it's what there will be. And in my mind, the question is just how we're going to get there. You know, a number of options. There's the possibility that we'll be able to do it in a peaceful civil manner through discussions and debates and agreements, and there's a possibility that we'll go the way of Yugoslavia, and that will be ugly and horrible, and I hope that we will be able to find a more peaceful route to things. In any case, it's clear to me that it won't be entirely smooth transition, because there are too many people, too many extremists on both sides that are blocking any attempt to really solve any of the problems in a way that I would prefer. But I'm sure it'll happen. I don't think that it's possible that we'll be able to exist together in under one state, because the state, our state, the state of Israel as now is, I don't think is ready and or able to treat the Palestinian people as equals and see that their rights are protected. Therefore, I don't see it ever being acceptable to the other side. Apart from which, I think it's clearly an Israeli interest as well as a Palestinian interest that we separate and hopefully remain good neighbors, but certainly not not try to function under one under one entity. And I think that the troubles of the situation one can see in Jerusalem as it now is, where we have two parts that are not at all equal, not treated equally. Their resources are not divided equally. The people are not treated the same. And it's untenable as far as I can see. And from my point of view, the question is how much can we do in the current situation to improve the situation in East Jerusalem? And I think that, of course, apart from the fact that I hope that in the very near future we won't be ruling East Jerusalem, I think it's our responsibility as long as we're there to do everything we can to try to make conditions there as good as we can. So that's kind of the effort I'm into, and I'm involved in. And ironically, there is some coordination and cooperation with the mayor's office and people of the right, people with whom I have very little to agree upon, but they, for their own reasons, understand that they have to do more to help East Jerusalem and try to improve the situation there. As I said, the motivations are very different. I think that we have to do more to improve the situation in East Jerusalem because it's moral responsibility and it's a humanitarian issue, and I want to remain on good terms with their neighbors. The people on the right see it as more, let's try to improve their conditions so that if there's ever a referendum, they'll choose to stay with us. Yeah. But in any case, let's do what we can to improve the situation and get involved in East Jerusalem so that the world will recognize that we're the rulers there and we'll leave our imprint there. I talked about East Jerusalem, which I deal with on a daily basis almost, and trying to see what that says about the two-state solution in general. And I think it's a similar thing, that the situation is similar, that we have, on the one hand, responsibility to do what we can to see the needs and minimal justice for all the people whose lives we're controlling now. On the other hand, have to work at the same time, do everything we can to make sure that a withdrawal will be possible as swiftly as possible, which means acting in every way possible to see that people who live there can lead their lives in as normal way as possible, considering they're under military rule, and also to do what we can to stop government actions from, you know, increasing the number of settlers that are settling over the Green Line, and do what we can to make sure that Palestinian land is held by Palestinians and not by anyone else. And as I said, I think that, you know, there will be a separation at some point, and the question is how, when, how peacefully, how bloody. There are things, you know, radical actions that I object to. I don't think that there should be, you know, I don't believe in boycotts, and I don't believe in certainly anything violent on the one hand. On the other hand, I think that we've taken too long, been too quiet in letting the occupation continue. I think people never dreamed it would go on. I actually, I did a doctorate on that focused on the years between 65 and 77, and no one dreamed that, you know, in 2015 we'd still be talking about what was going to be with the territories.
Like, occupation law is written to apply for only a few years, mm-hmm. right? And so it's not...
Well, there's no... I don't think there's any time frame, but certainly no one expected
it. I think when people wrote it, that's, you know, oh, nothing would ever last 50 years in this scenario. It's very odd. So, and I've spent a lot of time in East Jerusalem. I was volunteering there a lot, and I guess I'm curious about how the Jerusalem municipality does or doesn't deal with East Jerusalem. Like, how is the municipality able to sort of ignore all the things, like, say, in Shuafat through Sawiya? Like, how does this work?
Well, on paper, of course, the municipality is responsible for all the neighborhoods within the current Jerusalem borders, which were approved by the Knesset, you know, the law of Jerusalem, and that includes, you know, the refugee camp and Shuafat and Kfar Akiv and all kinds of neighborhoods that no Israeli has ever reached. And the way the municipality deals with it is they say, if you ask them, that they're responsible, and there are minimal, very minimal services that they supposedly provide to most of the places. But in general, what they do is, you know, make statements about Jerusalem being united forever and ever, and don't really do very much to change, ameliorate the situation, or anything else. There, as I mentioned, has been something of a change just in terms of taking responsibility in the last few years of at least some of the neighborhoods closer in, like Beit Hanina, certainly Shuafat, the neighborhood, and we now have the light rail that goes there and so forth. But we're far, far away from reaching any equality in the terms of the services or in terms of the way the people are treated, even in terms of the, you know, neighborhood councils, the rights they have, the budgets they get, are nowhere near equal. But I think there is some thought that more has to be done in those terms. I would say also that basically the worst situation is for the neighborhoods that are on the other side of the separation wall, which I've heard the understand that the mayor has said in private conversations that he'd just assume not have any responsibility for, and both he and the police basically go there as little as possible. The current police chief for head of the police in the Jerusalem region, I met with just a couple weeks ago, you know, says that he recognized he has responsible for going there, and he actually seemed to me honest in saying that. But the fact is that although on paper the police, for example, are responsible for their refugee camp, they avoid going there even even when there are crimes committed, even there are murders committed. There are 7 murders committed there in 2014.
Is that a fear or a lack of caring or both?
Both. I think what happened is there's a long, for some time, there's an attitude that the police didn't want to go there because they didn't care. and now the situation has deteriorated so much that they don't want to go there because they're afraid. And I actually have had complaints from Palestinian residents about the fact that the police don't get there, that there can be, as you know, as an example, a number of examples in the last year where there'd be a murder committed and someone would call the police, and the police would say, you know, sorry, we don't come there. So they feel neglected. And what has happened is that, as Palestinian residents there told me, if, you know, 10 years ago, they were concerned that the police weren't coming in, that, you know, they had no one to defend the individual people, and there'd be maybe, gangs or young men fighting one another, then it rapidly deteriorated into a problem with knives and knifing and drugs. And now now there are weapons, including atomic weapons there, and it's worse and worse for the people that live there, and less likely that the police will go in because they're afraid. I mean, it's going into an area that's where there are people living who aren't used to there being police at all.
I went there and talked to some members of a community center, and they said they want to organize their own police, like have civilian police each other, you know. But they said that it wasn't allowed, or I don't know if they were trying to go through the Jerusalem municipality channels to have some sense of authority or what it was.
There were some inquiries about that, but again, if this had happened maybe 10 years ago, it might have worked. But at this point, they're dealing with, you know, crime, organized crime. And I think one of the sad things is that a lot of Israelis, see what goes on there and rock throwing and are horrified and see it in terms of the conflict. But a lot of it is just, criminal activity. And a lot of the youth that are throwing rocks or scaring Israelis and so forth, I think have to be dealt with not as, terrorists or something, but as youth that are growing up in neighborhoods where there's no police patrol and a lot of poverty. A friend of mine was interviewed and talked about calling it the Intifada of the poor, because they're not, a lot of the problems they have there, again, that Israelis think of as, an Intifada or something, are typical behaviors in poor neighborhoods where you have a huge percentage of high school dropouts, not very much activities. They don't have money for, play tennis in the afternoon. They have no recreational facilities. They have very little to do, so they end up getting into crime. And it's sad because, as I said, not only do Israelis become fearful and does it reinforce all the stereotypes, all their negative stereotypes about Palestinians, but it's a threat to the Palestinians themselves who live there, who don't have anyone to call. If I think someone's breaking into my house, I call the police. If they think someone's breaking into the house, they call the police and no one will come. So it's a really tragic situation, I think, that there's a very, they don't have anyone who's really assisting them.
So for the future, not only of East Jerusalem, but say for all of Israel-Palestine, what do you think needs to be done? What do you think are some logical steps towards some sense of peace or partnership?
Well, first of all, I think one of the biggest problems in Israel in general, and certainly in East Jerusalem and even more so on the West Bank, is we need some law enforcement. People, you have so many instances of, let's say, settlers going out and chopping down olive trees or, attacking elderly Palestinians or all this kind of violence on that side. And also on the other side, I must say, of Palestinian youth in the refugee camp throwing rocks, and there's little or no law enforcement. I think it's a terrible thing for both sides and for relations between the peoples that there's no law and no order. Another thing that I think has to be done is more investments, internationally, whatever, so that people at least have things to live for and how to live, certainly in East Jerusalem, but also in the West Bank. I mean, I think it's, whether you're Marxist or not, poverty and all these things breed, affect the way people think and act and so forth, and people who are brought up in poverty and need, or, you know, grow up with a lot of anger and violence, and I think those are things we have to fight against. And another thing that I think we have to do is, you know, get to know and respect one another more. I think there's a lot of really ugly nationalism, racism, and other kinds of things developing in Israeli society, and also a lot of, you know, anti-Semitism, anti-Israelism developing on the other side, and I think more has to be done to teach pluralism, democracy, and respect for the other, because we have whole generations now that are growing up where the Palestinians know Israelis only as soldiers, and Israelis think of Palestinians only as terrorists. And I think it's very important to any and all kind of work to show the other side of life, that Israelis have children and concerns, and, you know, like anyone else, and the same on the Palestinian side. So I would say all those things are done. I mean, we need a structure that will allow us to live in terms of law, and we need more investment going into those things rather into, you know, some of these ridiculous things that money's being spent on, both within the city and nationally. And we need to understand and respect one another, which are huge problems in the education system on both sides that I think are lacking.
Mm-hmm. The generational thing is interesting to me, so I wanted to just touch on that for a minute to digress a little. Because Palestinians and Israelis have both said this to me, that they think a lot of peace is going to come from a new generation, this generation who's maybe perhaps more globally aware, more open, just really wanting peace, just wanting to live a normal life. But then also, it's clear to me that there's a generation that's only grown up, like you said, like with knowing people as enemies, as checkpoint guards, or, you know, living with a wall between them and their grandparents, or Israelis growing up with people throwing stones at them, or, you know, second intifada, a lot of people still have this very clear in their minds. And so I guess I'm curious on your opinion, if you think, what is stronger sense? Do you think there's a stronger sense of the people growing up in a new generation with more hate, or with more potential for openness?
Well, it's hard to say. I think there are a lot of things that the younger generations don't see. I mean, Israelis don't know that there was a time when, you know, Israelis and Palestinians, even under the occupation, you know, lived together, got along. I remember I served in the army by Jenin, and I used to go in uniform with an M16 on and go shop in the markets, and, you know, I felt safe. I know there are people before me, before the Intifada, that, you know, used to go and hike around the West Bank, and relations were different. I think even farther back, there's a generation that, you know, was used to having Israel and 67 borders and realized that was livable, you know, and that it'd be possible to give away, give back, get rid of whatever verb you want to use, mm-hmm. the territories, and still have a functioning country. And I think that the current generation both has grown up with this idea that without the territories we're, you know, we can't function, and with the idea that there's been war between Palestinians and Israelis forever, which is not true. There were periods of calm and much better relations. I gave my example in the army, but even far before that, and just people, you know, working together, children growing up together is different. But I think apart from that, we have a generation that's grown up with, as I said, with Israelis identifying Palestinians first and foremost as, you know, people to be feared as terrorists, and Palestinians growing up with Israelis as people to be feared as soldiers. And I think that does not leave us in a good position. Mm-hmm. There's also this incredible, really horrible propaganda in both societies about the other. I think that's bad. However, I think the good side, and maybe this is the only good side, because I must say I'm looking at the younger generation, I'm not all that optimistic. There is this thought that because of the internet and globalization, that Palestinians see something of our life, and we can theoretically see something of their lives, and understand that, you know, theoretically, we're all just human beings. So you could make that argument that there is that stuff out there that enables us to see one another and would give us some hope. But I can't say I'm terribly optimistic now. I think we have a lot of work to do. And I think the most worrisome problem is the leadership. I think leadership on both sides is incredibly disappointing. I think the Israeli leadership has been utter disaster, and I think the Palestinian side made a lot of mistakes in allowing, all kinds of propaganda and allowing to be drawn into a lot of the anti-Israeli stuff that go on when there was a brief time when it looked like we might have partnership under Oslo. But I don't know. As I said, there one could argue. Either way, I tend to be not terribly optimistic when I look at the young people because I see what fear and hate there is. But I generally believe that things can be overcome and that you can, teach other ways. I could also mention that yesterday I got back from a trip to Poland. Even then, a continent that was totally ripped apart by war for decades, they live together in the same union even now, so it is possible. And if I want to leave on a really optimistic note, I would say also that although it's sad to say, I think one thing that also comes out of all that's gone on here in the last 10 years is that people are tired of war. I know Israelis are tired of war. I'm sure I know Palestinians are tired of war. And that maybe that, not because of respect for the other, but just total exhaustion from the alternative, will mean that we will be able to solve this in a less violent way. Because I think most people realize that violence is really not a solution. If there are, 10 or 10,000 dead, won't really bring us any closer to a viable solution. So it's a kind of warped, backhanded optimism. But as I said, I think more than looking at the education or the situation today, I could just say that both peoples are so frustrated and have so given up from the alternatives that maybe that will bring us closer in a more positive way.
Yeah, I think it's also paralleled is that a lot of people that I've met, like the average folks, who aren't in an organization or doing activism, they just want to live their lives, and they're not paying attention to politics, which happens in most countries, but it's so funny to me as someone who's come here to do this work, meet people who aren't paying attention at all, because it feels so urgent for me, but for them, they want to live their lives. And, oh, that makes perfect sense. Of course you want to work on your career and your family and build a house, and so it's funny, just, okay, yeah, people are tired and they want to live a normal life, they're probably just going to go live a normal life, but I need enough people to fight for it.
I think I know talking with my own children, their friends, there are things that they just don't want to talk about anymore because they're sick of it and they want to go on with life. So as I said, it's not terribly optimistic because it'd be nice if everyone were, running into one another's arms and wanting peace and brotherhood on earth. That's not what's happening. But as I said, it may be just kind of exhaustion from the alternatives and a real drive just to survive. And here we go back to kind of the socialist view. But most people, I think, basically are the same and do want the same basic thing, which is to live a normal life, to bring up their children in a feasible, some relatively stable environment and, move along. So maybe that's what will bring us peace. As I said, I don't think it's any great love of the other or respect that will bring it, but since we've exhausted all the alternatives, maybe peace will come that way.
And so in your mind, if there is this two-state solution worked out and it started to get implemented, what would happen with the infrastructure of occupation, with the settler roads and with checkpoints and...
I think, the really frustrating thing is, from what I understand, from what I've read, we've never been closer to an agreement in that, everyone knows we have the 67 border, it'll be, we'll have a few kilometers here or there. Things are pretty clear. I think even in Jerusalem, most people know what it'll look like. There are Israeli neighborhoods, there are Palestinian neighborhoods. We have the old city in the middle that we have to figure out how we're going to manage. But it's not you know, the concepts are pretty simple, you know, Palestine to Palestinians and Israel to Israelis. So I think just about all things are workable. I mean, the refugee issues have kind of dropped off the agenda because I think there are, you know, there are numbers kicked around of 10, 20,000 refugees that would be symbolically allowed to move back. But in general, the idea is that refugees would be resettled in Palestine. And all the rest, you know, the borders can be settled. Jerusalem and someone who lives here, I also think that's not, it's not something that need, you know, prevent us from reaching a solution now.
So do you think that, say, in the future, in this scenario, someone, say, from Ramallah who doesn't have a permit to go to Jerusalem now would be able to just easily travel into what is now East Jerusalem, so they could go to the mosque and go, but maybe wouldn't be able to go, like, past what is now the Green Line?
There are different rules, but basically, you know, they say you have Palestine, you have Israel, you have the old city in the middle. Or you could say Jerusalem might be as a whole unit, would there be other ways of getting in? But, you know, there are so many ways to do security checks now. I don't think it would have to be, you know, so difficult or impossible. So, you know, for Ramadan now, fortunately, the Israeli government decided to let just about everyone that wanted come to the mosque. And they were granted 3 or 4, you know, horrible incidents. But considering the fact that there are tens of thousands of people coming in, beginning from Gaza and from all over the West Bank, I think, considering it all went as well as it did, we should be able to learn from that it would not be impossible to, you know, to open the city up and to make it really a center where both Palestinians and Israelis could come. So, you know, I think also there's been a lot of work done trying to, with surveys among settlers. Most settlers live where they live because they want a cheap land. You know, housing is so expensive in Israel. So if you move, you know, just over the Green Line, the cost of housing, you know, drops by 50%. Most people could be moved out. And as far as the fanatic settlers, you know, there are probably 10, 20, maybe 50,000 who are going to, you know, cause a bloody mess. Yeah. But that happens. We saw, you know, France pulled out of Algeria, and in the course of about a year, more than 1 million French people left Algeria, and it happened, and France moved on, still existed, and so forth. So, of course, the proportions are different, and the situation is not exactly parallel, but there have been huge population moves and exchanges all over the world. You know, if you're talking India, Pakistan, or, you know, Germany, Czechoslovakia, and, you know, you can move on. If there's a will, there's a way. I think the biggest problem that would be faced in this scenario, which I think will happen eventually, is the housing. Because as it is, Israel is in kind of stuck in housing costs. And if we move, you know, 300,000 settlers back home, it'll be, you know, a big project. But on the other hand, in between 1989 and 1991, Israel absorbed over 1 million immigrants from the Soviet Union, and no one was left sleeping in the street. So again, my sense is that if there's a will, there's a way, and if Israel decides that she's really going to finally do what she should have done many years ago and move these people out of the settlements and give Palestinian land back to the Palestinians, you know, it's solvable. It might even be good for us to, you know, get into a wave of building and provide in that way also for a lot of young people who are looking for affordable housing.
Interesting. So you would imagine settlers moving out of a settlement and Palestinians moving into those same houses?
No, into within Israel. I'm just saying that if Israel were to decide, as they did in 1989, we're expecting a huge wave of immigrants, we're going to build you know, housing for 300,000 settlers who are coming back home, you know, they could do that. And on the way, all that building would maybe, you know, affect the cost of housing in general, and it would go down. It'd be easier for young people. If they're, you know, I'm just saying, I'm not an expert on housing or real estate development.
No, it's always good to...
But I think that, you know, if you look at what happened between 1989 and 1991, Israel managed to build huge numbers of
of homes for people who are coming from far away, didn't know where they're going, and managed to absorb them all into the society.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're talking about Israelis who moved over 5, 10, maybe 15 years ago across the border, moving them back should not be, you know, an impossible task.
And do you think that the wall would come down in parts? Like, say, if you wanted to have a road back from Jerusalem to Bethlehem easily for Palestinians to travel, like that, you know, how would, like, I'm so curious on how that would work
the
in the
walls,
future.
I don't know. I don't know how the walls would work. I assume it'd be there for a while, but, you know, the wall is twice as long as the 67 border was, just because they made so many adaptations to allow the settlers to keep as much land as they could. So I don't know if that's an ideal border, but it could serve as a border for a while. And, you know, then we'll see. I don't know exactly what would come of that. But I think, as I said, it's, you know, everyone, including Arik Sharon and his successors, realize that 67 border is the basis that we have to go back to. So.
And if you had a border on the 67 border with two states, would it be... Would you keep a fence? Like, what is the border? You know, there's natural borders between countries that are mountains, obviously, but there's no...
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. As I said, I think the wall will probably stay in place for now.
That's
but,
what I
think. You know, there's this saying in English, good fences make good neighbors, I think. So, you know, there's something to that. But, you know, I hope eventually we could get rid of it. Regardless, though, as I said, I mean, that's the border. Whether there's a wall there or not, I think there will be. And I think, you know, Israelis will be concerned at the outset, at least, that, you know, there'll be control at the checkpoints and so forth. But basically, most of the checkpoints should be done away with, since they're all internal checkpoints in any case. And they're to make Palestinians' life difficult and settlers' lives easier. So once that would no longer be the goal, and rather the idea would be just to patrol the border, I think everything would be much simpler. It would also, of course, be simpler for Israelis, because now half of the soldiers in the army now are deal with patrolling on the settlements, and so we could, you know, release a lot of our soldiers a lot earlier and cut down on the time our young people spend serving if we could take that burden off of them.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah. And when it's interesting, if you read the Pinchas Shirut, the book that Rabin wrote after the Six-Day War, I mean, he wrote a chapter called The Burden of the Territories, because that was a burden. And somewhere along the way, someone tried to paint it, present it otherwise, but that's what they are in my mind. So I hope we can get rid of them, and then, as I said, among other things, it'll mean that soldiers, instead of serving 3 years, you know, maybe can get another year of life as free civilians. And I'm sure, I think that would do a great thing for, you know, for society, for them, and for everything else. Yeah, I think so. It's also, I think, something that isn't appreciated both on understanding Israeli society, but also on looking at the bright side, and that young people here, for all that we complain with great justification about the terrible government, you know, people give 2 and 3 years of their lives to serve the country. And some of them do things like teach and do positive things. And even those that don't, I think it shows something about the potential for, you know, galvanizing or doing something possible with the youth here, because they're willing to do something that, I don't know, I think my nieces and nephews abroad wouldn't do.
Yeah.
Of course, no one asks them. They don't do it out of choice. But it's something that comes into your, sets into your brain that you have responsibilities to the country. And I think you could look at that in a positive way.
Yeah, I think it's a huge annoyance for high schoolers in Canada to do their 40 hours of volunteer service.
Yeah, they have
over 4 years.
These two more positive things, but I think it's a good thing. Because people who are, you know, not willing to give to anything or are, you know, only driven by their own very narrow self-interest are people that it's much harder to deal with, because you have to give them, you know, immediate satisfaction or motivation that'll serve them in any possible way. And here, you know, I think people will be willing to say,
And for the good of the country, we have to say goodbye to some of the nice chunks of land that we've been taking advantage of, even though they're not ours. You know, maybe they'll be willing to accept that.
Yeah, and so I've been working a lot with grassroots organizations, and you obviously work in official politics. So mm-hmm. I'm interested in the potential for working together of grassroots organizations in Palestine and in Israel. A lot of them do work together, and then about the more official politics, and maybe if they can all somehow coalesce. I'm not quite sure what the relationships are like.
Oh, there's a lot of work with grassroots. I was part of, and still am active in a lot of NGOs in parallel to working politics. I think that, NGOs can do a lot of things that are, would be complicated for me to do as a politician. Even, there are people, certainly in East Jerusalem, that wouldn't want to work with the Jerusalem municipality, but if I go there, together with Peace Now or something, I'm more welcomed. On the other hand, there are certainly things that people in the NGOs come to me to help with, if they want budgets, if they want to change policy, if there are problems with roads or certainly housing demolitions or all kinds of other things. Ultimately, some politician or some city clerk sitting behind a desk has to answer that. So there has to be, I think, give and take and coordination, as I said, recognizing that there are things that NGOs can do that a politician with a label or whatever can't do. But I think, ultimately budgets, policy decisions are made, in the municipality and in the government. And so you have to know certainly things about, the West Bank and the territories. A lot of things are decided by 120 people elected to the Knesset, so you can do a lot of great work, but if you don't manage to work with and convince some of those 120 that what you're doing is right or what they have been doing is wrong, you can't, there's a limit to what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to work on both ways. You have to work with people and in the field, but you also have to know when push comes to shove, there's certain things that have to be done otherwise. I think there's a very important role for the NGOs to play in getting out to people in a way that, some politician or mayor or whatever can't do. Because if you go out and meet with people and speak at rallies and organize events and demonstrations or field trips, you can do a lot to. There's also the question of media and so forth that often comes and mediates between the two. If a lot of people go out and demonstrate, if tomorrow there's supposed to be a big demonstration in Sousse, if you get a lot of people there, both you reach out to the people there and also through the media or directly or indirectly, someone in the government will catch on the fact that what's happening there is, completely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So there's interplay, I think, and there has to be.
And what do you think are compromises or ways of being between the religious people and secular people that need to be part of a peace process or part of a future?
I think there's a lot to be done with religious and secular people. I think today the dividing line is less religious and non-religious because they're more secular people, let's say reform or conservative,
mm-hmm,
or whatever,
mm-hmm.
And there are religious people who are, who have all different kinds of political views. I think what needs to be clearer now is that there is a dividing line between people who ultimately recognize the rights, responsibilities of the state and government, and people for whom these things aren't important at all, which is the ultra-Orthodox community and some of the religious community, who basically, when push comes to shove, will do what the rabbis tell them and nothing else matters. And that is something I find dangerous and scary. It happens, I have encounters on it daily basis almost with ultra-Orthodox people who don't care at all about law because the Israeli law isn't important to them or whatever, and they'll do whatever their rabbi says. They have no independent thinking whatsoever as part of their daily life almost, and that I think is a big divide. Who is the ultimate decision maker? If you believe some rabbi and treat him as if he were a demigod, or do you use your own common sense? And unfortunately, Judaism, which was always kind of a religion of rebellion, even against God, and, you know, believed that, you know, was run, even in terms of religious sense, by rabbis who are not holy people. I mean, rabbis are supposed to be learned people, they're not holy people. I think what's happened is, over the years, especially in Israel, there's been this warping of the whole Jewish society to create people who are, to have rabbis recognized as authorities on things that traditionally they had no part of, and gives them a huge amount of power, which they shouldn't have, and really makes it very difficult to run a country, because you have a growing population that doesn't recognize these rights. And not only does it make it difficult, I, as a Jew, find it infuriating that they've taken this religion and so warped it. You know, you have people that go and ask the rabbis about anything, what they have to do with, you know, I don't know, not only whom to marry and what to say, but every question. And as I said, traditionally rabbis were not meant to do these kinds of things, certainly not decide about war and peace and anything else. And certainly that's not what Israel was about. You know, Herzl has this famous saying about how rabbis should be, you know, have their place, and they should stay in their synagogues, just way soldiers have their place in their job, and they should stay in the barracks. And you don't want to have a country run by the army, you don't want to have a country run by rabbis. You know, people have different jobs. So that is, I think, the most frightening and distressing development in this country, and it could conceivably cause a lot of problems in settling the issues with our neighbors.
Seems like a really hard one to touch, because I've gotten some dialogue with more Orthodox people, and it's really hard to talk in a way where there's actual dialogue. Like, it's not just you're talking at them and they're talking at you. Like, no one's actually listening.
Yeah.
And I've had some friends who do have some religious knowledge. So they've been able to get a little bit further than I could, but it's still pretty limited. So that seems like a very tricky...
No, it's scary, because you're talking with people and you just don't speak the same language.
Yeah.
I actually have
you
to go.
You have to go, yeah, you're looking at time. Okay.
But I hope I answered most of your questions.
Yeah, no, it was great. Okay. Nice to meet you.
Okay,
thank
you.
Good
to meet you too.
Thank you for listening. I hope that gave you some food for thought, and be sure to check back for another podcast coming soon. Thanks, bye.